Certainly is good to see everyone here. I was working on my PowerPoint presentation this afternoon, and I didn't realize neither Lindsay nor Tristan would be there to help me get it here, you know, put it on a thumb drive and work out some way to actually, so that we all could actually see it. So I want to commend Rick. He walked me through it, kind of like it would be kind of like you've heard stories about a pilot having a heart attack and dying, and then the tower, you know, taking a layman and you know, bringing it into a, you know, to the airport. So that's similar. So anyway, we've got it here, and thanks to Rick for that. I'm the first one to, we've been in the Old Testament all year. And so I'm the first one to launch us from the Old Testament to the New Testament. So I intentionally asked Joe to kind of cut the songs a little bit short. I don't want to make a practice of that, certainly. But I have a lot of material to share with you. And in fact, I'm not going to give it all tonight. I've got a sermon coming up in a couple of weeks that I'm actually going to be at that time getting into the book of Matthew, which will be slightly out of order because I think Earl is going to have a little bit to say on Mark. Is that right? On next Sunday night, yeah. So, but at any rate, we'll get to that a little bit later, and I have some other things to say about Matthew. But I want to kind of do three mini lectures, all for the same price of one. I want to talk about, first of all, with the present day, where we are and who we are in this generation and in this geography of the earth. And basically, how the life of one man has affected the culture of Western civilization generally. And so that'll be my first sort of mini lecture. And then the second one will be what the culture was like when the Son of God entered into this little blue marble spinning through space. And what was different and what was the same, you know, about what the history over those 400 years from the ending of the Revelation to the beginning of the New Testament and the coming of Christ. And how was it that things came to be the way they were with all of the different factions of Judaism and such as that? So that'll be the second lecture. And the third one, which I'll, for the most part, hold off until a couple of weeks when I'll have the morning sermon, we'll actually begin to look at the book of Matthew, or I will at that time, and talk about what's different about Matthew as opposed to the other Gospels, the three synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John, what it focuses on and why. So those are the three things that we'll try to get to. And so let's get started. No matter how old you are, and of course in this congregation, the oldest member here, which she doesn't get to come very often now, course, but is Donna Lee Hicks, and she's 100 years old. And then we've got young ones here, of course, as well. And everybody from Donna Lee on down has been brought up in a culture, an American culture to some degree, a Western civilization culture to some degree. And certainly it is impossible to escape the fact that we are living in a culture that has been largely shaped by the life of one man. And we don't really, it's like, certainly that's the case for the last sort of 1500 years or so, that the dominant worldview in Western culture, at least, and to a smaller degree in other cultures, Asia certainly is not as heavily influenced. But Christianity in its various forms has been the dominant cultural shaping force, including America. And, you know, being in a culture is kind of like being a fish in water. you're born in water as a fish, and you live your whole life in the water as a fish, and you die as a fish. So the fish doesn't know he's in the water. He doesn't know he's wet. And we're, unless you go out of our culture, you don't know you're in our culture. So I'm guessing that Joe and Gary and Joyce and Sandra might have experienced that kind of thing when they went to Israel. They were out of our culture to some degree, although Israel is certainly westernized. But if you were dropped in, you know, the middle of China, let's say, you would recognize an immediate difference. And so I want to kind of talk about those kinds of things a little bit. Of course, there's plenty of people, needless to say, that are trying with everything in them to erase the Christian culture, to whatever degree that is, you know, a part of Western civilization, away. They want to erase it as though it never was there. So for the next few minutes, I would like to take kind of a survey, both on a world scale and on a national scale, in various physical and mental evidences of basically the cause and effect of the life of Christ. How has it manifest itself? Is there evidence that there has been a life on earth, only 33 years or so, lived on earth that has greatly affected the entire world? So let's start with visible things. And for what is civilization known for anyway? And how are they identified? If you're talking about history, how is a culture identified? Well, one of the first things that, if you're studying history or you're an archaeologist and you're digging up buildings, things left by a civilization, one of the things that you would look at is architecture. It's one of the defining, certainly that would be the case in Rome, Greece, Babylon, Egypt, Europe. You know, there's something about architectural distinctions that set nations apart from one another and times apart from one another. So these are just some pictures that I got off of Google Images, and you can go all day. And of course, we're accepting the fact, you know, that we're not looking at these as what we might consider institutional excesses. You know, I'm hoping that we can just look at this objectively and say, this is the Canterbury Cathedral. These are things which would not exist had it not been for the life of one man, no matter what we think about whether it's a good use of money or not. We probably think that it is not a good use of money, and it has little to do perhaps with the church as in the New Testament. These are buildings, of course, but they're striking buildings and they're impressive buildings. And again, these are simply, and you can find these, you know, all over Europe. It's amazing how many there are. And you can, the interiors of these buildings are just impressive beyond words. I mean, the craftsmanship and skill that has gone into some of these church buildings is just phenomenal and incomparable in many ways. And if you're privileged to see some of these, they're remarkable to go into. And I know some here have been into some very remarkable buildings. I've been in this one, which is many of you, perhaps some of you here have. This is the Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. And one closer to home, that's St. Lawrence Basilica, 5 minutes away. Quite an impressive building, actually. And the interior, if you've never been in it, has the largest unsupported dome in North America, 5 minutes away. So if you've never been in there, I recommend you go in there. It's an interesting place to go. You can certainly go in there as an observer. And I have been in there several times. Impressive building. But again, my point for looking at these things is not our approval of this or whatever like that. We're looking at this as an objective view of what one life has resulted in, and the evidence of one life, 33-year life, and what manifestation, what is the effect of that one cause. Well, what else is a part of culture that would typically be cited? And of course, obviously the most important and would be literature. One of the most important would be literature. And the Bible, of course, this is the frontispiece for the 1611 King James Version. This is the first page, a reprint of the first page of the 1611 King James, which was, of course, a very influential translation from into English of the Holy Bible. And, of course, that one we could talk about for a very long time, so most of us all understand and realize that this is the book that has caused all of this influence that we find throughout the world. And both the Old and New Testaments completed it and combined, certainly since 1440 when Gutenberg first invented the printing press and began to print Bibles, was the first thing that he began to print. And so from that point forward, the accumulation of Bibles throughout our culture has been manifest. What about other writings? Well, other writings that have been influenced or inspired by various ways, and there, it's almost hard. That was Gutenberg, by the way, with his printing press. I forgot to put that one in there. 1440. Shakespeare, you know, certainly one of the most well-known, respected writers of all time, was writing from a decidedly Christian worldview. And if you read his various works, then you'll see that in there. These are just some that I thought of, and there's lots and lots more. Pilgrim's Progress, of course, is a story about a man's journey that sort of parallels a Christian life. It was a very popular book in the 1800s. We could do this all day, but Adventures of Robinson Crusoe was also a book about, and if you've kind of looked at books that were not the original one, or the Swiss Family Robinson, or other things that were kind of inspired by Robinson Crusoe, then you wouldn't know necessarily that it was very heavily Christian book, because what Robinson Crusoe needed to do when he was shipwrecked and separated from civilization is that he learned that he needed to trust in God, even though he was separated from a civilization that encouraged faith in God. When he was shipwrecked on an island, he learned that he needed to depend on God as an individual. And that's really what the book is about. So, In His Steps, this is the famous book that, was the original Charles Sheldon's book, What Would Jesus Do, is where this still popular saying, What Would Jesus Do, came from this book. And if you've never read that book, I recommend you read it. It's a good book. Many others, like I say, we could go on and on with these. C.S. Lewis, of course, has a very interesting life, was an atheist at one time. The Narnia series that has actually been made movies, you know, by Disney over the last number of years. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is just full of Christian illusions and allegories and metaphors and all of those kinds of things. Charles Dickens, you know, A Christmas Carol, full of content that is totally informed by a Christian worldview. And if we were to talk about dramas of various kinds in America, early American film and such as that, you know, It's a Wonderful Life would be one of those many that would come to our minds that was decidedly a work that is based on, again, a Christian worldview. So lots and lots of these things we could go over all night like that. Here's another, let me see what I've got up here next. Well, gravestones, and these are just a couple that I, if you go to any graveyard, what, you know, it's interesting how you go to a graveyard, anywhere, at least that I've ever been to, and what is the most prominent symbol in a graveyard? Well, it's always crosses. And I'm certain that that is true also in pretty much all of Western Europe, certainly true in America. The one on the left is an old Irish graveyard, and you can see the Irish cross there on the toward the right of that one. The other one is Arlington Cemetery, and of course, the, you know, images off of Google come from all kinds of places, and I happened to read the visited the page of this one with all the crosses from Arlington, and it was actually put up by an atheist group who is trying to sue the state to take down all of the crosses that mark the plots of soldiers, fallen soldiers in Arlington. So that's where that image came from. I just happened to put it on here. So you got people like that, you know, that are again trying to erase and squelch every semblance of Christian culture from our culture. So what else? Well, the other thing that's very prominent in civilizations is the law. Whatever law that they embody, that they write, that their senates or their kings write, relates to something larger than themselves usually. So in this is the Declaration of Independence, and if we were just to take the first couple of lines of this, and we won't read the whole thing, but just a phrase or two out of them. Here's one. The phrase in the first line, and I won't read the whole thing, is it says, "The separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them." In other words, there is an acknowledgement of God who created all the natural world with laws that are inherent within its creation. Our founding fathers recognized that there was a law that was inherent in the creation, and they're recognizing that there is a God who created that nature. And that is how they begin this document, is with the recognition of that fact. Here's the second line, part of the second line, which I know many of you could quote. "We hold these truths," and of course, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Well, we sort of take that for granted in this country. But if you were in India, if you were born in India, for example, do you think that in India that you would be considered having equal rights necessarily with everyone else? No. Why? Because the caste system. There's a caste system in India. And if you're born in a lower caste, you stay in the lower class. If you're born in an upper caste, you stay in the upper caste. So this is a fundamental principle that we recognize in America that is part of who we are in American culture. But that is not necessarily the case in other places. So let me go to the Constitution now for just a moment. The very First Amendment to the Constitution says this: Congress shall make no law, or at least part of it, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Everyone in here has heard those words before. This is a recognition on the part of our founders that in Europe, the long-standing marriage of church and state was actually detrimental to both, church and state, when they were married together, and tended to corrupt the sincere and individual worship when placed by the oversight of uninspired men. When the state oversaw the church, or the church oversaw the state, both of them weren't able to do their jobs properly. Because if you were compelled by the state to be a Christian or to go to an assembly, a church of some kind, then it wasn't a compelling or a persuasion that came from the heart of man. It came from the state. And that was not good for Christianity to have that compulsion. So our founding fathers recognized that it was inconsistent with free will that people were compelled to attend worship services of various kinds. So a lot more can be said about all of that. That's really all the time we had that we've got time for, but I trust that you can see that this ocean of influence that we're swimming in has been heavily influenced by the life of Christ. And that's really the main point that I wanted to get to on that. Now, what were the waters like in Jerusalem, Palestine, in the other areas, during the time when Christ entered into the scene? This is the mini lecture two, and we're doing pretty good. Given the impact that Jesus had on our culture, it is difficult for us to imagine a time when no one knew of the name and title of Jesus the Christ. Certainly they knew of the name Joshua or Yeshua. They knew the name Messiah, but they didn't know who he was. They did not have this conscious identification of one person like we have. From the earliest days of creation, God began revealing to the patriarchs and then through Moses and the prophets God's character and his master plan to transform man's sinful condition before God to a relationship with him that was not based on law-keeping as such, but would manifest forgiveness and grace and truth in a person. Not just in a law that is from God, but rather in a person. And that person would be Jesus. At the same time, God, at the same time, human, flesh, God in the flesh, Emmanuel, God with us. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, of the three promises, we've mentioned this quite often, given to Abraham, we've got the great nation promise. Was that fulfilled? Yes. We've got the land promise. Was that fulfilled? Yes. So what's left? The seed promise, right? The seed promise. So as Rick ended our Old Testament study last Sunday night, what was the condition of the Jews and what was their expectation for the future? One of the themes that we saw repeatedly in the prophets was future glory. With all the other bad things that, you know, God was pronouncing, the idolatry and sin rampant and all of that. But oftentimes, one of the other themes in the prophets was there was going to be future glory for Israel. A covenant, a new king, and a new agreement, a new covenant with Israel. Well, let's talk about the state of things at the close of the Old Testament. Even though we know that Jerusalem's walls and temple were being rebuilt by Ezra and Nehemiah, and this is incidentally a picture that I I found since Joe was going through Nehemiah, well, one of the scenes of that was him going around the wall and inspecting it, you know, before he began to talk with the people about it. So there's a picture of that, Nehemiah going around and inspecting the walls. So we know that Ezra and Nehemiah, by the authority under Cyrus and above him, by the authority of God, providence of God, were doing this. They were rebuilding the walls, they were rebuilding the temple and trying to restore their national life. But not all the Jews returned to Jerusalem after the exile. They were scattered throughout Babylon, Egypt, Palestine, and other areas all around. And because they were scattered, they formed synagogues, which was not the temple. But the synagogues were a place where the Jews would come together to read the scripture, read the law. They would pray, they would sing. There was a place for them to gather. And because of the role, that throughout this time, I don't know if I put a picture of the, yeah, this, there was a picture I found that was of one of the oldest synagogues, it's believed, to have been established there. But the role of the priest had declined after the exile, and because of the numbers of synagogues, certain schools of thought began to emerge from that. The sectarian nature of Judaism that we find in the Gospels that we're sometimes just surprised by. So where these groups come from? Mainly the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but there were actually a lot more than that. It was almost a denominational, like we have among Christianity generally. We have a lot of factions and divisions among people who would call themselves Christians, and it was the same way in Judaism during this time. Well, how did all that come about? Why was that? Well, probably, for the most part, it was because they had lost the priestly line and the authority that came from God through the priestly line of the Levites. And they were divided up among the nations, and they met in synagogues. And so it was not a cohesive, unified temple worship and a worship under the Levites as it was in times past. So that certainly contributed to it. Also, the rabbis were becoming the respected teachers. Eventually, there were many factions and denominations of the Jews throughout Palestine. There were zealots, as we mentioned, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, scribes, Samaritans, the Sanhedrin, who were probably the most wealthy and influential, developed the extra-biblical writings, known the Talmud and the Mishka or something like that. But there was a lot of... So these divided groups and schools of thoughts began to be very prominent. So what happened? What was happening historically in these 400 or so years there between the Old and New Testament? Well, the Persian throne and empire gets shaky, and those are some of the factions there. But the Persian throne and the empire gets shaky, and eventually the fall of the Persian Empire comes in 300 BC at the hands of Alexander the Great of Macedonia. Most people are very familiar with that. Under the Persians, the Jews had relative peace and official cooperation, but things began to change as Alexander sweeps through Syria and Palestine and Egypt, and he destroys the city of Tyre, a fulfillment of the prophecy of in Ezekiel, and establishes a new city on the Nile named Alexandria. And that's a sort of someone's remaking illustration of what it might have looked like. The lighthouse there was is considered one of the seven wonders of the world that the ships could see for 50 miles out. So it was quite a place that he was constructing there. And among the things, Alexander eventually begins to push even towards India, and it was his soldiers that said, "We can't go on. We're just worn out. We're tired. We don't want to keep going." And so no telling what, Alexander might have tried to do, but he did try to push towards India. But all of this, he loved Hellenistic or Greek culture, and he was trying to spread Greek culture throughout the domain that he had conquered. And so that was very important for him, and there was a lot of Greek influence then introduced into all of the known conquered world of the time. And among the effects of that is that Greek, the language of Greek, became a universal language. And certainly there were still languages spoken, but people, as they also often do these days, like English, when they're in another country and speak another language, they become bilingual. They also speak English. And the world of the time, if they had one language, they also spoke Greek. So after Alexander's death, there's a power struggle and land grab. I'll say, incidentally, this is the library, or someone's conception of the Library of Alexandria, which was Alexander wanted this pool of scholarship to be in his city there on the Nile of Alexandria. And incidentally, when I was looking this up, there's actually that sort of disc-shaped round architectural building there is actually the library that apparently, or they believe, is built on top of the original Library of Alexandria. And that is, I didn't know about this at all before I looked it up. That's the interior, part of the interior, quite a, a monstrous building. But anyway, that's again, we could look at that and say, well, these are cause and effects. These are things that have just fallen out because of movements, great movements of human civilization in the past. These are things that have come to pass. So after Alexander's death, there was a power struggle and a land grab among his generals, four mainly, although two of those become more prominent. One of those is Ptolemy, starts with a P, Ptolemy, you could say, I guess. Ptolemy, usually it's pronounced. The first who captures Jerusalem and takes a number of Jews to help colonize Alexandria and encourages Jewish scholarship at the great library at Alexandria. It's estimated that the library there had 700,000 volumes. Scrolls is what's estimated to have been there. And of course, it burns, and it burned eventually. And the burning of the Library of Alexandria is still somewhat of a mystery. We don't know, apparently, why it burned, who burned it, and that kind of thing is somewhat of a mystery. But Ptolemy II commissions a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures for his library. And that Greek translation will eventually virtually replace the Hebrew manuscript over the next 300 years. And of course, that would be the Septuagint version of the scriptures. And there was I found this among many other ancient fragments of the Septuagint version, which incidentally, more often than not, is quoted in the New Testament, the Septuagint version. Is quoted. So in 201 BC, there's another emerging power who has a big military victory over Hannibal. Most people remember Hannibal and his elephants, his army of elephants. Well, even with his elephants, Rome still was the victor in that battle. But from this period, there is a lot of sort of complicated history where dealing with pacts made between rulers, and eventually the Jews revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, who set up an altar to Zeus in the temple and offered a pig, apparently, and that's just a little drawing I found there, on that altar, just to sort of, you know, diss, mock, whatever, you know, make the Jews angry and furious and mad about it. Well, he succeeded in that. He succeeded in making them mad enough that they revolted. And those that revolt is particularly known or along with the Maccabean family or the Maccabean revolt. And you can look at the first and second Maccabees in the Catholic Bible and learn some things about that. So that is the beginning of much of the story of the Maccabean family. And they initiate this revolt and eventually achieve a kind of dynasty of sorts, but they're still under the thumb of Rome. In 63 BC, so we're coming closer to this way. 63 BC, we're getting closer to the time of Christ. The Romans invade Palestine and capture Jerusalem, but still, even under the control of Roman power, a measure of self-rule is still evident in Jerusalem. Augustus Caesar is now the ruler of Rome, and eventually, of course, Herod becomes a ruler of that area. There's Caesar. And he calls, there is instituted by Caesar at this time a thing called, a law called Pax Romana, or Roman peace. And that was a big part of why there was a measure of peace throughout the next couple of hundred years. The Roman peace. They wanted peace. They had been fighting a long time, and people were tired of fighting. And so this seemed to work. And many books, of course, have been written about this period of time. And this is kind of the briefest sort of summary of it. But there was an unprecedented peace and prosperity and generally good civil government during this period of time under Roman rule. For our purposes tonight, just from the outline version of events, as I believe that we can see that God is providentially bringing about what I believe Rick had a little kind of a survey or a focus on this subject not very long ago, which was the fullness of time. Remember that phrase, the fullness of time. When the fullness of time came, God sent his son into the world. Well, you can see through the events that have come to pass that God is bringing about the fullness of time. Now, among the things that you would say, well, there was a universal language, and that was one that we already noted that would be key to spreading the gospel quickly. The relative peace and prosperity, which means in practical terms that people had time to do something other than war and feed themselves. You know, I think they had time to reflect, time to listen, time to observe, time to think about all the things that had happened, time to read the scriptures. I mean, we in our lives have those kinds of, aren't there times in your life that you don't have time to read and reflect? You have to work. You've got a deadline to make, or you've got bills to pay, and there's just too much going on. But other times in your life, you've got time to reflect. You got a little bit of time to read and think. And that was the time here in history where they had time to read and think. And so that was a part of this providential time in history where the fullness of time was being manifest, that was ripe, that was right for Jesus to enter into the world. Let me see. We're about out of time here. I'll tell you what. I think I'm going to stop right there because this is a reasonable place to stop. I'll leave you with this. What were, after the Jews had these hundreds of years of beings under the suppression of Gentile nations, being overcome, being conquered, being exiled, being captive, and then finally coming back to some semblance of order, but still under the Romans, what would you think that their expectation would be when they read the scriptures about that there would be another king coming, and he would be in the line of, he would be like David. He would sit on the throne of David. But what was David known for?
War.
David was a man of war. And David was known for conquering his enemies, particularly the Philistines. So when they read that this king would be in the line of lineage of David, then what would their expectation be as they were still under bondage in a way, even though they had some freedoms, but still they were under the thumb of Rome? So we will just keep that in your minds from now until 2 weeks, and we'll resume there. So thank you very much for your attention. I know I didn't give very much time. Is there anything anybody wants to say about any of that before we close? Okay, very good. Thank you for paying attention. And I guess if there's nothing further, you got, Gary will come up. Thank you so much.